And thanks to you all for turning out on such a night. I gather it's going to be -6 later on. Okay, I'm going to talk about robots like us. About the first half of the talk is going to be basically what's happening, what different kinds of robots like us there are. And the second half, I'll be talking a bit about the work we're doing here at Sussex. Now, what I'll be reporting on is ongoing stuff. Basically, what we've done is we've created a very interesting problem, which we haven't solved yet. But I hope you enjoy looking at the problem anyway. Okay, so where did robotics start? It started in 1920. The Czech author Karel Čapek wrote a play, RUR, Rossum's Universal Robots. Now, I'm not going to run through the plot. I'll just tell you that the robots end up killing all the humans. And that was the beginning of robotics. But let's have a look at what the robot was like. Well, there's one, dressed according to his stage directions. They were indistinguishable from people, except for a mechanical quality, slight mechanical quality in their voice and in their movements. They were actually made out of soft stuff, protoplasm. And when Čapek realized that real robots or the later science fiction robots were metallic, he said he was revolted by this concept. They ought to be soft. And more of that later on. Okay, something for the Vice Chancellor here, out of the text, about the robots. They learn to speak, write, and do arithmetic. They have a phenomenal memory. If one read them the Encyclopedia Britannica, they could repeat everything back in order, but they never think up anything original. They'd make fine university professors. What happened in reality? Well, not very much until the 50s, when an American engineering entrepreneur, George Duval, applied for a patent for what he called a programmable mechanical arm for repetitive or cyclic industrial tasks. And he called this universal automation. And a couple of years later, an even more entrepreneurial associate, Joseph Engelberger, founded a company, Unimation. When the patent was granted in 61, they sold their first industrial robot. Well, here's what it looked like. That's the first one, not recognizably human. So was there any input there from the idea that it should be human? Well, there was. Again, that's the effect it's had. That's a car factory. They all look like that. Now, if you squeeze and strain your eyes, you might see three or four humans skulking in the very back of there. But it's what engineers like to see. No human beings to mess things up. The original Unimate, according to a member of the design team, had to be anthropomorphic. But engineering and cost problems meant the end result was very different. Any link to human morphology had been lost, and the successors were even less anthropomorphic. And there were 1.3 million of them currently employed at the last count. Of course, a lot more than that have been manufactured, but they only last about 12 years. But remember, they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So that's what happened, the real robots. So why is anybody bothering to build robots like us? Well, we can pick out five possible reasons. The first is to carry out tasks designed for humans in an environment designed for humans. It makes sense to have something that fits the task and the environment. The second is to entertain, impress, or intrigue us. In other words, not to do anything useful. The third is to act as substitute humans in social situations. Now, this is something we'll hear a lot more of, and there's a certain ethical fringe of concern around this. The fourth is to exploit physical abilities unique to human beings. Yes, there is one, and I'll tell you about it. And the last one, and probably the most recent, is to investigate human cognition. Okay, to begin at the beginning, carry out tasks designed for humans in an environment designed for humans. Well, here's a strange environment. It's the International Space Station, and it's 200 miles above the Earth's surface. And you can see the size of it. This is the crew module. It's really quite big. There's a lot of it. And even though it's in space, it gets damaged and it needs repairing. So it was designed to be maintained by astronauts, cosmonauts, or taikonauts, are the Chinese ones. But this is going to be too difficult and expensive in the long run. Costs a lot of money to get one up there, a lot of money to keep them there, and a lot of money to get them back. So it's going to be maintained by human-like robots using human tools, robonauts. And there's two Robonauts. They're made by NASA and General Motors. They are the R2s, and one is R2A, and one is R2B. I don't know which is which. So they're definitely morphologically similar. They just exist at the moment from the waist up. But there's a catch here. Does anybody remember the Popeye character Bluto with the enormous chest and biceps? It's huge. This is understandable. It's got to be strong. And giving it a slightly greater reach is going to certainly not give it any disadvantage. But even the torso there weighs 300 pounds, about 140 kilos. But then it's in space. It doesn't really matter. And in fact, one of them, I'm not sure if it was that one, went up on the last Discovery shuttle and was actually trialed in the International Space Station, and you can watch that on the NASA website. Okay, the second category, to entertain, impress, or intrigue us. Well, to entertain, there are toys. We're familiar with these. They're getting better, cheaper every year. I think Robo Sapiens was the hit the Christmas before last. There's the little gizmo you used to make it go through its routines. So they entertain people. And what you could also do is buy them, take them to bits, and take the motors and gearboxes out, because they're far better engineered than anything you can buy in the shops for the price. So I've done that many times. The second is a bit of a mystery. This is the impress. The Honda car company have for 25 years been working on robots. The series is now known as Asimo, and it's officially Asimo's 10th birthday. There's one of the Asimos. Incredible engineering. Absolutely top class. The problem is that nobody knows what Asimo is for. It goes around doing public events. It's rung the bell to start the Wall Street trading off. It's conducted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which you'll see later on. It advertises Honda, basically. When people kept on asking Honda, well, why are you building this? He said, well, we're a transport company. We're interested in mobility. In the last few years, they've been saying that they hope to develop this into something that can be used to help around the home. One of the problems there is, as you will see in a moment, it's actually quite small. So so that's the size. So it's going to have to grow a bit if it's going to be really useful around the house. But as I said, very, very impressive engineering, top-class technology that they won't talk to anybody about. So that's in the impress category. This is in the intrigue. Again, it's Japanese. I won't have the sound on. You will hear a high-pitched voice saying things in Japanese. Cosmetically, excellent. Looks like a human being, and it does catch attention. Time to time, looking at it, you think, oh, really? I thought it was a person for a minute then. This fades in and out. As you can see, a lot of the work has gone into the cosmetic appearance. The movements, the gestures, are still actually quite clumsy. And if you look at the facial expressions, they're not all they might be. This is actually better than some. What these are used for, well, again, they're eye-catching novelties. If you have a stall at a trade fair and you have one of these, you will have a cluster of people around your stall, no matter what you're trying to market, whether that's a good thing or not. They paid attention to all the cosmetic aspects, by the way. So the third one, and this is where I'm going to only touch on this, but this is something that people have had debates on about whether, to what extent it is legitimate and desirable to use robots as substitutes for humans when we've already got plenty of humans. The one on the left there, that is Professor Hiroshi Ishiguro of Osaka University. He was involved in producing the Actroid. And the one on the right is the Geminoid, which is an almost exact cosmetic replica of him. Again, I'm not going to show you the facial movements because they don't actually match up to the cosmetic, but the cosmetic is absolutely great. And in fact, I read the other day when I was thinking, how did he even get the hair right? That the hair on the Geminoid is in fact hair plucked over the years from the head of Hiroshi Ishiguro. Now, whether that's true or not, I can't vouch for. In a way, I want to believe it, but in another way, I don't. But again, when you're looking for cosmetic excellence, the Japanese are currently the leaders. And these aren't just... the function of this, the alleged function of this, is to give lectures while he's sitting at home. Right? So, well, I can understand that. But here's another one of his products, the Geminoid F for female. And this has a rather different purpose. And this is quite intriguing because it was actually modeled on, I believe, the woman on the left. There's some earlier film where they look very much more similar. I think there's been a slight change in the one on the left. The other one, they haven't got the hang of aging these things quite yet. But the idea is that these will be, in one of their applications, observers in hospitals. They will sit around in the corners of rooms and observe what's going on. And the idea seems to be that people won't be at all disturbed by a human being, apparent human being sitting in the corner just looking around. Because behind those eyes, those rather blank eyes, are two very powerful cameras. So these can be used for gathering information. I don't know what happens to the information after that. They've done the trials in the Japanese hospitals, and apparently the Japanese patients are, most of them are quite comfortable with this idea. I find it slightly bizarre myself, but on the other hand, if the alternative is a security camera panning backwards and forwards, maybe this is preferable. Again, wonderful cosmetics, not terribly good movements. Now, the fourth is to exploit physical abilities unique to human beings. Now, you think, we can't have any. We are generalists. We're not as strong as gorillas. We can't run as fast as cheetahs and so on. What is it that we've got that is better than anything else? It's these, our hands. We are the world's greatest manipulators, not just in the Machiavellian sense, but in the physical sense. And these are the model. If you want to equip a machine with something which is going to be able to manipulate almost anything, then this is what you want. So there's a lot of research going into how to make a hand as good as a human, not necessarily for replacing a human hand as a prosthetic, but actually for use. And there is the hand, the DLR-2, built by the German Air and Space Agency. This is pretty much the state of the art. Extremely good movements. I think it's only got three fingers, but a very, very good thumb. But it's got force control, it's got very good touch sensitivity. It's a brilliant piece of engineering. And they will keep working on this and working on this until they get it right. But when you look at it, you see, well, it's actually a little bit bulkier than the human hand. Well, there's also a British hand made by the Shadow Robot Company, the Shadow Dextrous Hand. And as you can see, this is delicate. It's even slimmer than the human hand. How do they do that? Well, you can begin to see the secret there. The forearm is going to be like Bluto. And you can see the tendons, the strings, which actually operate the hand. And this is, working with tendons is very difficult, but this is one of the ways to get a small hand. And it's why our hands manage to be so small. So anyway, so I hope I've made you happy and that you can walk home proudly thinking, well, I've got the best manipulators in the world. And you have until some roboticist improves on it. Okay, and the last reason for wanting to build robots like us is to investigate human cognition. Now, again, to talk about that seriously, well, we'd be here all week. What I'm going to do is pick a single time when it really started in robotics and take it on from there. Now, in the mid-80s, a young AI professor at MIT, Rodney Brooks, had an epiphany. He suddenly realized that the AI-based robots that he'd been working with for some time, they were wrong. They were misconceived. The idea of intelligence achieved through building representations and then reasoning over them and so on. Real intelligence, biological intelligence, wasn't like that. So he invented what he called behavior-based robotics. Your motors, your sensors connect the one to the other. Behavior just happened directly. Using these techniques, he made spectacularly simple, cheap, fast, and impressive robots. He founded a company which was later called iRobots. This is the major supplier of robots to the US military and also the major supplier of robots to domestic environments because they produce the Roomba automatic robot vacuum cleaner. That was a brilliant insight, but in 1993, he did it again. He was thinking about what is it about human intelligence? And he was reading and talking to people. MIT is a good place to do that. And he wrote this: recent trends in artificial intelligence, cognitive science, neuroscience, psychology, linguistics, and sociology are converging on an anti-objectivist, body-based approach to abstract cognition, where traditional approaches in these fields advocate an objectively specifiable reality. These newer approaches insist that intelligence cannot be separated from the subjective experience of a body. The humanoid robot provides the necessary substrate for a serious exploration of the subjectivist, body-based hypotheses. And this was really quite revolutionary. He was talking about going from these very small robots. A lot of them had legs, and the AI lab that he ran was often referred to as the artificial insect lab, and he was proposing to make the leap from insects to humans. By building a humanoid robot, programming a large number of simple behaviors in it, getting it to learn others, especially through interaction with humans. And the idea was that the behavior would then become more and more capable, intelligent, and because of its human body, human-like. So this was the idea. It was a great vision. Unfortunately, it didn't achieve its original aims, partly because he was unable to obtain adequate funding. In fact, the work was done mostly by master's students. I think in the end about 50 of them had worked on this, and each of them did a bit, and the problem seemed to be that when they'd got their degree, off they went, and nobody could get their bit to work again. So, but the amount of attention it received from within and outside the robotics community was incredible. It was obviously the right idea at pretty much the right time. Was there anything wrong with the original conception? Well, I think one of the problems with it, as you'll see in a moment, is that the embodiment wasn't very human-like. And there it is. And if you compare that to some of the robots you've just seen, this was the state of the art in 1993. A lot of that stuff was made for the first time in his lab by the students, making parts on machines, and that was the best that could be done. So the ideas were right, possibly the time wasn't. But also, perhaps we need to find a little more of a human embodiment. So what would a very human-like embodiment look like? Well, there are two ways of designing humanoid robots, basically. The safe way, the regular way, you take mechanisms you know you can build and control and buy and so on, and assemble them to form a machine that fits within a human envelope. This is what's done with Asimo. There's a European robot, the iCub, which is specifically designed to study cognition, but this uses entirely conventional engineering, and there are dozens of others. This is the sensible way to do it, because you can make the things work. So there's a selection of them. We've seen Asimo before. This is a standard toy. That's the iCub in the middle. Again, beautiful engineering, but you have to ask yourself, is that really like a human being? So, what's the other approach? You can copy the mechanisms found in humans, copy their arrangement in the human form, and see if you can find out how to control the result. And these are the robots that I've been building over the past 7 or 8 years. The first one, Kronos, we did at Essex, and the second, Eke, we've done as part of a European project of which Sussex is the leader. How does a robot that's what we call anthropomimetic, which is a word I made up to distinguish them from humanoid, how does it differ from one that's merely humanoid? Well, one way of seeing this is to look at the I don't know what to call Gunther von Hagen's productions. These are real dead people subjected to a process called plastination and then put in entertaining poses. But people go along to these exhibitions because you can see what humans really are. And the trouble is that with your skin on, you can't, unless you're a surgeon or a medical student. That's what's inside us. I like this one, the chess player, particularly because there's nothing more cognitively abstract than chess. And you look at that, and all you see is the muscles. That's another way of saying these are doing some of the work. And what pleased us when we made our first robot, which is on the left there, was it started looking like a Gunther von Hagen's preparation. You see the linearity, the bits of string, and so on. Well, you can see them on the chess player as well. There are four technical characteristics which horrify engineers, but they're actually intrinsic to our physicality. And I'll just run through them very quickly. Basically, we're driven like the shadow hand, by tendons. Basically, we pull on these elastic strings, and that's what makes us move. The trouble with tendons is you can't push on them. So if you want to that sort of movement, whereas a normal humanoid robot, you just need one motor, one gearbox, and just reverse it, no problem. When you use tendons, you need two for each degree of freedom, so this is known as redundant actuation. Oh, we don't want that, say the engineers. Multi-articular joint actuation. This, again, is something that horrifies engineers. If I were a humanoid robot, my elbow would have one motor and gearbox in it, and that would be it. One joint, one degree of freedom, one motor. How do I actually do that? Well, I actually use my biceps for that, which starts in the shoulder, goes over some surfaces, and then joins on my forearm. So it crosses two joints, at least two joints. And again, this is something that horrifies engineers. It's needless complication, but that's what we like. In fact, most of the muscles in your body are involved in multi-articular actuation. Compliance is just elasticity. If you look at these humanoid robots, they're what we call stiff. They can hold a pose really well. But we, even I, are really quite elastic. Our muscles are elastic, in fact, they're variable elasticity, and our tendons are elastic. We're just about to watch the Olympics, those of us who are interested. And remember, when you see the high jumpers in particular bouncing before they do their great leap, what they're doing is actually getting the energy in their big, thick Achilles tendons that, if you're really unfortunate, you will snap one day, and that is what propels them up. We exploit the elasticity. It's intrinsic to being human or mammal or animal, and conventional robots just don't have it. And we also have complex joints. An engineer likes a joint like a hinge joint or a rotary joint. Those are good. We can make them. We know how to control them. We have joints like, for example, the shoulder is a nightmare. We've got three bones there. Your shoulder blade is not really held on by anything except muscles and ligaments. It can move around. It has 6 degrees of freedom. We've got to have all four of these if we want to claim that our robot is anthropomimetic. And what I'll do now, we had a few technical problems earlier on, so I'm going to show a bit more of this than I would have otherwise. This is what we call the teaser video made by our partners in Munich, and it shows some of the shots from here. This is the first robot we built, Kronos. It only had one arm at this stage, and we hadn't had the courage to give it a proper shoulder yet. When we built the left shoulder, we did that one properly. You can see all the elasticity here. You can see the complexity of the construction. This, by the way, is what we call shock cord, but those of you with motorbikes and boats will know it's the bungee that you fasten things on with. It's actually sleeved natural rubber with very good qualities. The bones are made out of this stuff, polymorph. You can just heat it up. So here's some polymorph. What we're doing here is actually making a finger. You can heat it up with a hot air gun or in a microwave or in a bowl of hot water. Mold it. Around about 60 degrees, there's the hot air gun being used. It bonds very well to stuff. It's stable. It's slightly more flexible than bone. and each of those fingers can be made in one go. So this is the really good shoulder moving. And that's just a cheesy bit at the end. But look at the shoulder. If that was a humanoid robot, that would be one or two motors at best. Look at all the motion there. We've got something like seven different motors for the single movement. And what I don't think it's, yeah. I hope what was going to be on that video was showing us letting it down one motor at a time to get the point across that you have to coordinate all these things. So building these things is, engineers think it's not wise. So that was our first try. That was at Essex when I moved here with the new project. We decided to build a better robot. Again, after Hiroshi Ishiguri and the Geminoid, I have to say that this is my research student, Alan Diamond, and this is the robot. But we're working on making Alan more like the robot every day. You get some idea of the size. It's got a much longer neck than we have, but everything else is pretty much in proportion. That's actually mounted higher than it normally would be. And you get some idea, the chest is absolutely full of stuff. One of the problems with these is making it small enough. We've got a lot in there. Nature's got a lot further with miniaturizing technology than we have. But again, every year we're better and better. So what improvements have we made? Well, Eke Robot is much more accurate anatomically. If we look, for example, at the spine here, you can see the level of detail that's got into that. How much of this is necessary, we don't yet know. But what we have discovered, for example, is that the mechanical qualities of the discs that have to go between the vertebrae are very important. After the robot's been vertical for 8 or 9 hours, it starts developing scoliosis. And so at night, we have to lie it down when it will grow about 3/4 of an inch, just like you. You don't notice this. So we've learned a lot about our own defects from this. How much this relates to cognition, I said, we do not know. But we're going for accuracy where we can do it. This shows a view of the two completely floating shoulder blades. We do make some, have to make some adjustments because we have to fit motors and gearboxes in very tight spaces, so we do vary things. But you get the idea, we've got the short ribs there. You can see all the elasticity going there. I don't know how many of you are meat eaters, but when you're eating the bit of an animal down next to the spine, you have these wonderful thick muscles like that. Well, we now know that you really need the power in those things to actually keep your spine and ribs under control. A very difficult structure. Again, not well designed. Engineers wouldn't have done it that way. This, difficult to see, but what we actually put in, instead of the rotary joint that they use on the humanoids, we've actually got a radius and an ulna, the two curved bones in your forearm that actually do that rotary movement by, again, moving over one another. We've made some other engineering improvements. Lower friction, which means lots of Teflon, more powerful motors. We were lucky to be sponsored by the Swiss motor company Maxon, who make the best motors, some of the best motors in the world. So that's made a real difference to us. We get a much better quality of movement, more and better sensors. So again, there is a lot of sheer engineering goes into these things. It's not just the bones and the elastics. And this shows, this is from about a year and a half ago. And I hope you can see the additional complexity we've got into that compared to the first cut that we did at Essex. So it's now got both shoulders. In fact, you'll see in a minute, I think, when Rob Knight, who makes the robots, was very keen to demonstrate his shoulders. So there's a lot of this, which you can only do if you've got the proper shoulders. Yeah, I think it's yep. Come on. Yep, so the shoulder business going on. You will notice, by the way, that all these robots shake. This is because they don't have one of the reasons is they don't have a control system in there yet. But the other reason is that we don't have, as we'll see in a minute, we don't have enough damping. Damping is what stops oscillations in machinery. We didn't have these problems as bad with the first robot because there was lots of friction in there, because we hadn't got the knack of getting rid of that. Get rid of the friction and you get more problems. So we don't have any damping. We also don't have any variable stiffness. Our muscles are able to control, if you like, their spring constant, their spring rate, which enables us to do some very interesting things. We don't have that. We can't do anything about the bungee. It's more or less linear, and that's it. The changes in tension are much slower than we can get with muscle. Muscle is brilliant stuff. If we could only get artificial muscle, that's from nothing to full contraction. Whereas with our motors, we have to wind a cord round a spindle, which pulls on the elastics. Everything is much gentler. We have very good kinematics, so that's the postures you can actually get into, but questionable dynamics. We don't actually have the right velocity profiles that humans do. That can probably be fixed with the control system. But the big thing is we don't know yet whether or how much any of these things matter. But what we're doing is we're erring on the side of, well, if in doubt, put it in if you can. We haven't got to the stage yet of saying, you don't need that, you can leave it out. So several questions arise. How should we attempt to control this beast? Well, we're looking at three different approaches. Classical engineering, forward modeling of the robot and the environment, which is most of what we're doing here at Sussex, which I'll explain in a minute, and something called sensory motor control. That's similar to behavior-based control, and that's being done at the University of Zurich. So, classical engineering. This is done by our colleagues at the Electrotechnical Faculty of the University of Belgrade. They were robotic pioneers. Even when Yugoslavia was still a socialist country, they were getting contracts from the United States. They were the leaders. And they and the people we're working with were the first people to think about robots that had elasticity in their joints. So what they've done is done their mathematical wizardry, come up with a control system, and they can now control any number of monoarticular joints, so as long as the muscle just crosses a single joint, they could cope with an entire skeleton. But the problem is there aren't many monoarticular joints in the human skeleton. And in fact, one of the quotations we treasure from our colleagues there was when one day in a discussion, Professor Podkoniak, their leader, burst out and said, "The problem is that the human body was not designed according to engineering principles." And this really sums it up, because if you build it, it's a real problem to control it. And you have a real problem explaining to an engineer why you did it like this. Oh, you could have left that out. You could have done this. Well, of course we could. But if we'd done that, we might have inadvertently thrown the baby out with the bathwater. The problem is at the moment we can't tell the baby from the bathwater. Now, the forward modelling, this really is a carryover from the project at Essex. The project at Essex happened because I got funding to try and build a conscious robot. And at the time, I believed that the essence of consciousness was your internal model of yourself. And other people believe this as well. But I thought, if I'm to have a robot with an internal model of itself that was as similar as we could get to my internal model of myself, then I needed a robot as similar to a human being as I could get. So this was a consequence rather than the primary aim. So I said to Rob Knight, my research assistant, could you build me a robot just like a human being with skeleton, muscles? He said, well, he went away, got a copy of Grey's Anatomy, and be careful what you wish for, is all I can say. He did it near enough to make us realize what the problems are with dealing with something like that. We didn't actually achieve consciousness, but we did achieve something that we were happy to call a kind of imagination. And we'll see, and this is from, what is it now, 4 years ago now. There's the robot. By that time, it was getting a little bit stiff. It has a visual system. It's detected this. It has an internal model of itself and its environment. You see the stick moving around. This is actually seeing. And from its repertoire of movements, it's got to come up with something that produces the perception of a horizontal red stick. And by a happy chance, tries this movement first time, and then downloads that command to the real robot. Okay, now that's incredibly crude, and it took an awful lot of effort to do, because what this is no ordinary model, it's actually a physics-based model. So the laws of physics are programmed in there, so everything in there is compelled to behave as it would in the real world. The robot model, we had to cut a few corners there, but we'll have a look at the latest model of that. But the idea is that by using a physics-based model, we don't have to say, when it touches this, we make this go over there. We have no control over that. What happens is what happens, just as it would in the real world. So that is a kind of imagination, which is pretty high up on the list of cognitive skills, of course. So if we have a physics-based model of the robot and a model of the environment, as it now is, then we can use a selection of techniques, AI techniques, to search for motor activations producing satisfactory actions, download them to the robot, as we saw, if we can do it fast enough, because the idea is that we're going to do this between the ball being thrown at us and catching it. So we do everything in advance. Okay, we've got to do that. So we haven't got to that stage yet. But this is the idea. There's lots of evidence that our brains do contain these sorts of models. So first thing we need is a better and faster robot model. Well, Alan Diamond has built the physics-based model of one of the new robots. I would have called it a labor of love, but his temper in the year or year and a half it took to do it made it seem that it was tough love, at least. So there is the computer model that he built. You can see that it's got the motors there, and the motors are modeled down to all the electrical details there. We've made parts of it transparent so you can see what's inside. The bungee is thinner there than it is. This is, again, what we want is something that's functionally okay. But the original idea was we'd get all the robot parts that would be scanned and digitized, and then we'd simply assemble them in software. But the robot had to be built so quickly because of an impending review from the European Commission that what was delivered to us was the entire robot. So what Alan had to do was to photograph every part of it, wiggle the bits, and then, because he's left-handed, he was able to construct 3D models of each part. There were, you can imagine how many parts there were. This was a tremendous achievement. Anyway, now we've got it. At the same time, two postdocs, Bhargav Mitra and David Devereux, have built the visual system that can capture the 3D environment, actually locate the target object. We use a Lucozade bottle for no good reason that I can think of, and insert the environment and a model of the bottle into the robot's physics-based world. So that's a picture of what we come up with. There's the robot. It's mounted on a trolley, which it eventually will be. There is the Lucozade bottle. This is the table. And all the dimensions are pretty good, and the location of this is accurate to within a couple of millimeters. And again, that took two people the best part of a year to do. So simple ideas, lots of work. And what Alan's doing at the moment is finding ways of getting the model robot to interact with the bottle. And what we're doing is we're starting with giving it as little information as we possibly can, and it's essentially just learning what to do in order to knock the bottle over. It gets rewarded every time it manages. So we replace the bottle, stand the robot up again. So there's no finesse there at all. We don't expect there to be yet, because we're just at the moment rewarding it for managing to hit the bottle, and it's getting pretty good at that. One of the things we're looking out for is whether the structure of the movements is actually the same, if it's using the same what we call synergies, muscles moving together, as human beings use. So again, a lot of work involved in getting to that stage. We haven't put a control system in there to actually get it to correct its posture yet. This would be an extra that will go in pretty soon. The sensory motor control, this is only just starting. This is going on in Zurich. And essentially, this is a return to Rod Brooks' ideas, coupling sensory inputs to motor outputs with as little as possible in between. The idea is that the morphology and the intrinsic dynamics of the robot will facilitate human-like movement strategies. In the jargon that's developed around this kind of work, you will get them for free. This is being done in Rolf Pfeiffer's laboratory, and Rolf is the author of books with titles like How the Body Shapes the Mind. So he's the right person to do that. Again, we're still waiting for the results for that. So, $64,000 question. How could we show that a human-like embodiment contributes to human-like condition? Well, we've been thinking about this for a while. There's a technical solution to this, and I won't go into it in much detail. We'll attempt to characterize the relationships between motor inputs, movements, and sensory inputs using a range of what are known as informational measures. These are actually quite abstract, and we will then see if the results can be identified as being more similar to the outcomes of applying these measurements to a human than to comparable outcomes from a conventional robot. So we would expect that to be the case. Exactly how that relates to cognition per se remains to be investigated in detail. But also, since Rod Brooks' epiphany in the 1993 one, a lot of books have come out, a lot from the philosophical side of the movement. Some of the influential writings were by Andy Clark, who used to be at Sussex, of course. There's lots of new ideas around. And what we're going to do is explore these ideas in the literature on the relationship between embodiment and cognition, because we're going to be in a position to put them to the test. Most of these books are in the realm of theory and argument and so on. We've actually now got the experimental base that we can use to test them. Lots of teams are using the conventionally engineered ICUB, the European standard, so there should be plenty of comparisons available between our embodiment and the conventional. So, will it be possible to produce human-like intelligence in a robot? Well, I put this in as one of my teaser questions in the abstract because it's always asked at the end of a robotics talk. And what I'm going to do is to give you an unqualified yes. But my reasons for that may disappoint you. I'm a materialist. We're material things. The brain is a material thing. I can see no reason whatsoever why we shouldn't be able to reproduce the functionality of these physical systems. I can't see any block. But what I will say is that our idea of intelligence has changed radically in the last 20 or 30 years. It's not just the involvement of the body. What we now know, for example, is that in decision making, if you lose your capacity for feelings and emotions, you become hopeless at making decisions. So intelligence is not a dry, abstract, logical, reasoning thing. Unless you have got this capacity to feel and to respond to feeling, you're not going to be able to function intelligently. So when I'm talking about intelligence, I'm talking about this broader thing. But I see no reason why it shouldn't be done. Don't ask me to put a time on it. Okay, but looking around here, I won't see it, but I can see there are a few of you who well might. So that's my way of wriggling out of the question of producing human-like intelligence. And of course it will be in a body like one of our robots. And the other question is, will it be possible to build a robot that is conscious like you? Well, perhaps I've already answered this question, because in my experience of human intelligence, human consciousness is a necessary part of that. And I can't really see any way of producing human-like intelligence, not human-level intelligence, human-like intelligence, from which the consciousness was missing. So if we do the first one, we'd probably have to do the second one anyway. But again, we are a material system. We exhibit this subjective phenomenon of consciousness. I see no reason why we shouldn't be able to do it. The technical question of how we would know it had been done is something else, but it shouldn't be impossible to do it. So, this is my wind-up. It should be abundantly clear by now. I've been talking about problems. We don't have any answers yet. But what I think we've done is we've created the right problem to solve. And we're asking the right questions about it. So it's unfinished business, but I hope from what you've seen, I hope maybe it's entertained and intrigued you. It may not have impressed you, but thank you very much.